Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. The Canadian Hearing Society wants to improve services for Aboriginal clients and will be soon hosting a gathering in Ontario. A mom, with the help of her community, is trying to avoid institutionalizing her son, who lives with multiple disabilities, but they're facing a lot of red tape and are taking the government to court. The Kana Way to Win campaign website has been up and running. The website is to address awareness of woman abuse in Aboriginal communities throughout Ontario, and this issue is close to one woman's heart. Lac Seul First Nation in Ontario wants the province to fix burial grounds in the community, and it has also launched a land claim. Bomsida will also spotlight music from Métis artist Shane Anthony. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Marvin Yellowbird, chief of the Samson Cree Nation, is mourning the loss of his five-year-old grandson. The boy was killed during a shootout at a house in Obima on July 11th. RCMP told media that gang activity may have played a role in the shooting in the Alberta Reserve. Police also say there are about six loosely organized First Nation gangs operating in the area. In the past, the community has been riddled with violence and plagued by drugs. Chief Yellowbird says prevention work has been ongoing for the last several years, and RCMP say they're working with the community to find whoever is responsible for the death of the young boy. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo is calling for the replacement of the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development. At the AFN General Meeting in Moncton earlier this week, Atleo says the department should be replaced with a body to deal with First Nations on a government-to-government basis. And in scrapping the former Indian Affairs Department, the Indian Act would also go into the garbage. Meanwhile, APTN reports some chiefs have raised concerns that the AFN is ignoring the view of treaty nations. Some chiefs in Saskatchewan and Quebec drafted a resolution to restrict the AFN from bringing down the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. The chiefs say there needs to be more time, consultation, and treaties need to be respected. However, in his opening speech, Atleo acknowledged the treaties. One policy analyst told APTN the move of some of the treaty chiefs was a bit of an overreaction, and that Atleo has made it clear that it's up to the chiefs to drive a process to correct the system. Nine people from Poundmaker First Nation in Saskatchewan are facing nearly 50 theft and fraud charges. According to the Lloydminster Meridian Booster, the chief is among those that have been charged. An RCMP spokesperson told media earlier this week that all of the nine people, whether former or current, held positions of trust, being the chief, councillors, or treaty land entitlement trustees. All nine people are facing charges related to the misappropriation of band and treaty entitlement funds. The investigation began in 2004 by Cutknife RCMP, and 2 years later, the investigation was handed over to the Commercial Crime Section. The funds were part of a Treaty Entitlement Framework Agreement in 1992 when Poundmaker settled with the province for just over $13 million. RCMP are investigating the death of a 12-year-old boy on a First Nation in northern Saskatchewan. The Globe and Mail reports police were called to a shooting incident in Lac La Ronge First Nation, but by the time police arrived, the boy had died of his wounds. At this time, police say it's too early to determine what exactly happened and whether or not there was foul play. Residents and business operators in Caledonia, Ontario are eligible for compensation because of a long-standing land claims occupation. The province has set aside $20 million for direct losses as a result of the Six Nations protest. Canadian Press reports the plaintiffs have developed a process to determine how the cash will be distributed based on loss. Attorney General Chris Bentley hopes the settlement will help Caledonia residents move forward. Lac Seul First Nation in northwestern Ontario is trying to save some gravesites from shore erosion. The First Nation has also filed a land claim for unsurveyed reserve lands. Chief Clifford Bull says the shoreline has been slowly eroding since the 1930s when a dam was built near the area. He says some remedial work was done in the 80s, but nothing since, and recently a skull was found. Bull says they would like to have more remedial work completed.
Certainly would like to see some sort of perhaps a retaining wall be put at the graveyard where the skull was found, and the remains to be respectively picked up and reburied at a higher level, higher elevation, and then some work and money put towards a retaining wall, perhaps with riffraff and maybe some rock and concrete, so we can stop the erosion in that area.
And as for the community's land claim, Bull says they want an historical correction made right from the 1850s.
So when the commissioners went up there, the surveyor went up to Shoal Lake near River Falls. Four families were living there, but there was nobody there at that particular time. So they felt that the area was abandoned. So they left and went back to perhaps Ottawa, I guess, and so we want to revisit that treaty arrangement again.
Lac Seul is comprised of three communities, including Whitefish Bay, Keechee Bay, and Frenchman's Head. Maureena Beadle is trying to keep her son Jeremy from being institutionalized. The single mom lives with her 16-year-old son and her First Nation, Pictou Landing, in Nova Scotia. Beadle has been caring for her son all his life, but last year she suffered a stroke and needs extra home care. Jeremy lives with multiple disabilities, including hydrocephalus, known as water on the brain, cerebral palsy, and curvature of the spine. Extra home care means more money needs to be spent for care, and there's a lot of government red tape to go through, and Beadle says her son will not be institutionalized.
They told me if I lift off the reserve, and the total cap is $2,200 a month, but over that, a Jeremy requires more than $22,000, maybe about $4,000 more a month. So they said that over that, they have to institutionalize him. And I said, well, no, over my dead body.
The community's health director, Philippa Pictou, has been trying to access Jordan's principal for more funding. Jordan's principal is a child-first principal adopted in the House of Commons in late 2007. The principal calls on the first government of contact to pay the bill to look after a child and then sort out payments later. Pictou says meetings were held with different levels of government and the results weren't too promising.
It took us five conferences until they decided what the normative level of care would be if he lived off reserve. And what they came back with on that was that there would be a maximum of $2,200 of services that we would be able to spend on, combined services for any one family. And after that, then the child would have to be put into an institution. And I thought that did not seem right, and I've been a social worker for a number of years and have worked off reserve as well, and I knew that if that had happened off reserve that I wouldn't have accepted that the child should be institutionalized because they didn't have they needed more than $2,200 worth of care.
Meanwhile, it could cost about $6,000 per month for the extra home care for Jeremy and his mom, and institutionalizing the 16-year-old as recommended by government would have a price tag of just over $10,000 per month. Pictou Landing First Nation is taking the federal government to court over this matter, and since the matter is going before the court, Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development says it cannot comment at this time. An Aboriginal man in BC has been awarded $5,000 from the BC Human Rights Tribunal. The man had claimed racial discrimination while in jail in the province. The Vancouver Sun reports Travis Kelly was unable to access a Native spiritual advisors or a Native inmate liaison while in protective custody. However, when Kelly asked for Christian reading material, it was readily available along with a chaplain. The tribunal has also recommended that BC correction centers ensure that Aboriginal prisoners have fair and equitable access to spiritual services and counseling. The first Native Deaf Gathering is fast approaching. The Canadian Hearing Society is hosting the event in Whitefish Lake First Nation near Sudbury, Ontario. Cheryl Wilson is the Director of Ontario Interpreting Services at CHS. She says the gathering will be a first step towards improving services for Aboriginal clients.
Over the past year and a half, we've had Deaf Native consumers to our agency come forward and ask about the services we're providing to them and how we can improve upon them. So our first thought was to work with the community to host a gathering. Just as a first step, sort of a shared learning experience, we have offices all over the province, and we serve consumers in a variety of ways, employment, mental health counseling, Ontario Interpreting Services, obviously, but we're not sure we're serving the Aboriginal community well.
The event has been set for August 5th to the 7th. Prime Minister Stephen Harper is an honorary chief. He was so named by the Blood Tribe in Southern Alberta July 11th. He was also given a new name, which is Chief Speaker, translated from Blackfoot. Harper was honored with the title and name for the residential school apology he made in 2008, and he's the third Prime Minister to have been honored with a chieftainship. The two Prime Ministers were Lester B. Pearson and John Diefenbaker. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
So cold, so clear, so blue. It's gonna break me as it's gonna break you. There's a hard road to being true. I put all my trust in us together, but then you went and found somebody better. There's a fast track to feeling lonely. I'm on the fast track. I'm feeling lonely. Soon the summer sun's gonna crack the ice. I can feel it in my bones, so tender and nice. I can fall in love with some other's eyes. I left you over there, oceans apart, with some new guy to make a brand new start. I can fall in love with feeling lonely. I'm on the fast track of feeling lonely.
The Chain Anthony Band with Fast Track from their first album, Hands Like Mine. The Canadian Hearing Society will soon be hosting the first ever Native Deaf Gathering. The gathering will be held in the beginning of August in Whitefish Lake First Nation in Ontario. Cheryl Wilson is the Director of Ontario Interpreting Services. She explains why the organization has decided to hold this first gathering.
Over the past year, year and a half, we've had Deaf Native consumers to our agency come forward and ask about the services we're providing to them and how we can improve upon them. So our first thought was to work with the community to host a gathering. Just as a first step, sort of a shared learning experience, we have offices all over the province, and we serve consumers in a variety of ways, employment, mental health counseling, Ontario Interpreting Services, obviously, but we're not sure we're serving the Aboriginal community well. So this is a two and a half day event over our weekend at Whitefish Lake First Nations, and we have probably about seven Representatives from the agency attending from the various programs, and probably around 20 deaf Aboriginal community members from across the province coming.
Okay, and you were also saying that you've been kind of working on this for the past year and a half, and you've had First Nation citizens approaching you with suggestions. And so what are some of the suggestions that are coming from them to improve services for the Aboriginal community?
The role I play, I was primarily getting concerns around interpreting services. So we would always attempt to deliver service, but they would always be a non-Aboriginal interpreter, for example. So there may be losses of cultural context if it was a band council event, for example, or a medical appointment where maybe the elder was talking about traditional healing approaches. The non-Aboriginal interpreter may not have that cultural context to bring to the work. So that was clearly a gap in our ability to meet their needs. And then as our conversations moved forward, it moved to other areas that are not in my responsibility, such as mental health addiction counseling, for example, or employment counseling. So it became pretty evident that it wasn't just about interpreting, that as an agency as a whole, we maybe need to consider how we are meeting the needs and how we can better meet the needs of the deaf community in the Aboriginal community. So the event in August is the first step. We need to learn more. We need to know what we can do better and how we can go about doing that better, and what the community has to offer to help us do that.
Oh, that sounds all pretty cool. And so do you think that that maybe interpreters would need some cultural awareness training or something along those lines?
Absolutely. Ideally, we would like to have interpreters from the Aboriginal communities, and we do have two actually attending with us in August, so they're few and far between. We don't talk about them as Aboriginal interpreters, we just talk about them as interpreters, but as we start to go through this process and bring this more to, to agendas across the departments and the agencies, we will want to draw upon that expertise and that cultural knowledge that they would bring to their job, not just as an interpreter. So ideally, we want the interpreters to come from the community. So part of our goals for the weekend is to talk about some long-term planning. Can we encourage more Aboriginal youth to look at interpreting as a profession, work with the colleges around the interpreter training program and making those accessible to Aboriginal youth, for example, who may have deaf parents? So those are kind of the long-term objectives. In the short term, absolutely, professional development and training opportunities are critical. This is this first step is not a training opportunity for interpreters per se, more for sort of management to get a better understanding and to have to come out with some ideas on what the next steps are and how we can do things differently, which may include some cultural training, absolutely.
That was Cheryl Wilson, Director of Ontario Interpreting Services with the Canadian Hearing Society. Jeremy Miyawasage is 16 years old, and he lives with multiple disabilities, including hydrocephalus, which is also known as water on the brain, cerebral palsy, and curvature of the spine. He lives with his mom, Marie Beadle, in their home in Pictou Landing First Nation in Nova Scotia. Marina suffered a stroke last year and has needed extra help at home to care for her son and herself, and that's costing the First Nation. And they're having trouble getting the extra needed funding from the government because of the red tape involved. And instead of subsidizing the extra care, the government has recommended institutionalizing Jeremy, which actually will cost more. The community has taken the federal government to court, trying to access Jordan's principal to get more help. So first we'll hear from Marina and then Health Director Philippa Pictou.
Well, they did an assessment on us, right? And Jeremy falls under the institutional, under the category of being an institutionalized child. And cap is $2,200 a month, right? So they told me if I lift off the reserve, and the total cap is $2,200 a month, but over that, a Jeremy requires more than $22,000, maybe about $4,000 more a month. So they said that over that, they have to institutionalize them. And I said, well, no, over my dead body. But anyway, it's the financial barrier that we're having problems with, like getting funds from someplace. So when the Jordan principal came in, then I watched it on at the tail end of it on APTN, and I said, I'm fighting that. And then sure enough, when we became candidates for the Jordan principal, I said, I'm fighting to the bitter end. I don't care. I said, even if Jeremy and I don't benefit from it, but our women will that are having a hard, same kind of problem that I am having and getting funds and stuff like that for their children. So they wouldn't have to struggle the way I have, going from one place to another just to try to get funding.
Tell me what a typical day is like for you and Jeremy.
Before I took the stroke?
Yeah, before and after. Tell me everything.
I took the stroke. Jeremy and I were always on the go. Either we'd be at the beach or someplace, or on the powwow trail. You know what the powwow trail is, eh?
Mm-hmm. I do know what the powwow trail is.
Okay, so anyways, we would go on the powwow trail in the summer. And, like, you know, Thursday, we leave Thursday, then stay until Sunday or Monday. Then come home just for that 2 days and then leave again to Thursday just to come home and do laundry and whatnot and go somewhere else and go to a powwow. Or either spend time at the beach doing, that's where Jeremy got all started from, was the beach, like from the time we tried to get him to set up on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that the beach was where we got him to, where I got him to start to sit up on his own. And all the therapies today, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, you know, started at the beach each year. It was a long process, but it was well worth it too.
Mm.
And that was basically what we did during our days sometimes. But now that I'm home, we spend more time at home after the stroke.
Mm-hmm.
I have workers that come in and they care for Jeremy so that I don't have to do it on my own anymore. And whenever we can go out for a cruise, we go out for a cruise, which isn't too often because the weather hasn't been too good to us this year. But now it's too extremely hot. And our days are usually filled with, like, being busy with Jeremy and getting him fed and his first, he takes a shower, feeding him, dressing him up, changing his pamper, all the other things that we have to do with him.
Mm-hmm. If Jeremy were to be institutionalized, where would he end up? And would you happen to know the cost of that?
The cost of it would cost per day $350 per day. And it wouldn't be in the province of Nova Scotia. It would be out of the province. The only place that they would have an institution for the age barrier for Jeremy.
That was Marina Beadle talking about the difficulty trying to access more funding for home care. Philippa Pico is the health director at Pictou Landing First Nation, and she explains the process the community has undertaken over the past year.
She had been his sole caregiver right up until last year when she suffered a stroke. And following her stroke, we needed to put in home care services in the beginning for both her and Jeremy because she wasn't able to care for him anymore. And when she came back from the hospital, she was still in a wheelchair and, you know, very weak. She's getting better. It's been a year now and she's walking with a cane and she's still got a lot of weakness on one side. So she's still unable to provide for his physical care, but she's been there. You know, it's definitely supervising everything that's happening with him and providing his emotional support and being there with the workers. And so after we put in the services, I put them in the spirit of Jordan's principle in that they needed the care right then, and I wasn't about to start arguing about which government was going to pay for it and leave them without having the care. It was a life and death issue with him. And so I started at that point then trying to figure out about how to access the funding through Jordan's principle. I knew that it had been adopted by Parliament and that, therefore the government should kick in and that they had focal points in Nova Scotia that we were supposed to go through in order to be able to access it. Anyway, it's taken us a whole year. She had the stroke in May 2010. And what we could find out from the government in the beginning, they didn't want to provide us with very much information in the beginning. Well, they still don't, really. And what we did find out was that we had to be denied the normative level of care, that's their words, for what he would have access to if he lived off reserve and was in a similar situation. So from that, I realized that in order to establish what that was, I needed to be able to have the province do the assessment in the same way that they would if he lived off reserve. And so that took us 5 months, because what we were told is that continuing care, who would normally do the assessments, are not allowed to come on the reserve at all. And even though on reserve we don't have access to that type of assessment that would be needed in this kind of situation, and at the time, Pick Landing didn't even have a nurse. We were in the process of advertising to get a new nurse. And so we were having to hire VON to come and do home care assessments, and the home care assessments were not nearly the kind of detail level that he would have if he was being assessed reserve in, for these particular types of situations. So it ended up that we had to go to the Minister of Health and get ministerial approval for continuing care to come onto the reserve to provide the services to have them assessed. And she also made it very clear that there was no financial support or service support included in that, but that they could talk to us about, case conferencing and all that kind of thing, and they could do the assessment. So that happened in November. So it took us from May until November to actually get the assessments done. And then when we had the assessments, what we did was set up a series of case conferences that involved INAC and FNIB, First Nations Inuit Health, and provincially continuing care and community services and the Pictou County Health Authority, and then our health staff and the mother, Marina. And what I wanted to get out of those case conferences then was to try to access the Jordan's principle and also to access any other services that we could have put in place right then through the province. Anyway, it took us 5 case conferences until they decided what the normative level of care would be if he lived off reserve. And what they came back with on that was that there would be a maximum of $2,200 of services that we would be able to spend on, combined services for any one family. And after that, then the child would have to be put into an institution. And I thought that did not seem right, and I've been a social worker for a number of years and have worked off reserve as well. And I knew that if that had happened off reserve, that I wouldn't have accepted that the child should be institutionalized, because they didn't have they needed more than $2,200 worth of care. So I started digging around, and I came across a recent court case, Boudreaux versus Community Services. And in that, a woman a non-Native woman with a son who had autism, who lived in Halifax, had, I'm getting some kind of weird feedback, but anyway, she had taken Community Services for a judicial review, because Community Services had told her that even though she was getting more than the $2,200, and she said that wasn't enough, that she couldn't have any more funding, even though she needed more to be able to provide the care for her son. And so the judge had ruled that the $2,200 is an administrative kind of thing that Community Services put in place just to cap their spend, and that it actually went against the Nova Scotia Social Assistance Act, and that act had the intent that if a person was in need, as defined by community services, then community services was obligated to pay for the full cost of whatever those needs were that were defined as necessary. And so he ordered community services to pay for the full amount of the care and also to review 35 other cases that were similar in Nova Scotia. And then out of that, too, I came across the community services policy book, and they have a whole section on extraordinary circumstances and exceptional circumstances, and Marina and Jeremy would have been able to meet all of them. And it's right in the provincial policy that if you had any one of those situations, that your case manager could approve either short-term or long-term funding above the $2,200 cutoff. And what we were told is that we weren't allowed to access any other funding, and unless we wanted to redo our whole funding agreement with INAC, and instead of having block funding, move to a set agreement where we had to report on it on a monthly basis, basically. And that would have been for all of our funding, all of our social funding, which would have been not just things like assisted living, but our housing and our social assistance. And so that would have been completely different from what the standard of care would have been had they lived off reserve. And so after that, then I started bringing it to our local tribal councils, and I brought it to the, we have a tripartite process in Nova Scotia, which is federal, provincial, and First Nations governance. And so I presented to the health tripartite. And then from that, it got sent to the First Nations Caring Society, who agreed with me that it was a Jordan's principal case. And they sent it to the AFN, who also agreed that it was a Jordan's principal case.
That was Philippa Picto, Health Director at Picto Landing First Nation. Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development declined to comment because the issue will soon be before the court.
Following the sun from room to room and mat to mat, is it for the warmth? I'm not so sure. I can tell he is smiling, 'cause it heals. There are miracles.
That was the Shane Anthony Band with Miracles Here. The Kanawetuan campaign website hopes to bring awareness to women abuse in Aboriginal communities in Ontario, and it's also equipped with much resources. Jenny Boyer is the Healing and Wellness Coordinator at the Indian Friendship Center in Sault Ste. Marie, and she knows firsthand how valuable a tool the new website is.
The Kanawetuan campaign is a program for violence against women, and it's to bring awareness and promote healthy lifestyles, I guess.
Okay, so I've learned that the rate of violence against Aboriginal women is higher in this community, and why is that?
I believe that the Aboriginal women within Sault Ste. Marie have a higher rate of violence upon themselves, because this area here specifically is a place where there's a residential school. So the Aboriginal women around here, basically, the women are descendants of the women that attended this school here, this residential school. Therefore, we found that there is a lot of women that have been raised in homes where they had no parenting skills, no sense of belonging, loss of identity, loss of language, loss of tradition. They also were raised in homes where there was a lot of alcoholism. And today we find that our young moms are still facing the impacts of residential school.
So it sounds like the violence just doesn't affect Aboriginal women. It sounds like it affects the entire community.
Exactly. As women, as Aboriginal women, we were taught that we are the backbone of our families, of our communities, of our nation. And when we have a history where there where there's been a lot of violence, a lot of alcohol, a lot of drug abuse, spousal abuse, we find that it's affecting the generations of like the past generations plus those that are coming. So what we're trying to do with this program, Can Away Twin, is bringing awareness to the women to stop domestic violence, to stop violence against women, because we have little ones that are our future, and we have ensured that we're going to have strong, healthy leaders, healthcare workers, teachers, aunties, grandmas, just more a healthier and a healthier community.
Since it does affect an entire community, how has violence against women or violence period touched your life?
Well, for myself, the being raised in a home where there was no violence, being raised by grandparents, living a good life where there was no alcohol, no violence, and then once the loss of my grandmother, having to leave my home and be raised in a home where there was alcohol and where there was violence, I carried those scars with me, and I brought them forward into my life. I raised three sons with that message, with that experience. I raised my sons not to hit another woman, because someday those women will be the mothers of their children. So with that, when they went into their relationships, I told the women that if my sons ever lay a hand on you or verbally abuse you or feel fear, you call the police. You know, there's nothing else that you can do. You have to. That's one way of stopping it. It's not going to. So they will not be abused. So that my experience in my life growing up, having been abused, having being abused physically, mentally, emotionally, I more so want to be able to help our women today that are experiencing that abuse, to let them know that there is help out there, and you can become strong again, and you can learn a new way of life, a better way of life, by implementing the seven grandfather teachings. The Can Away Twin program has those teachings in there, and they have some guidance and direction on how to gain your self-confidence, gain your self-esteem, your self-respect, bring back your spirit again.
As a family member or a friend or a co-worker of a woman that we suspect is being abused, how can we help?
I believe that I think by letting them know that there are other places out there as well that can help, like there's if they go online or if they go look at canawaytwin.ca, if they are afraid, they're fearful for you know, that they don't want no one to know what's going on, that there are places that they can go where they can have that sense of confidentiality. They can call crisis lines. They can find a friend, ask them to go and look for an elder that they might feel comfortable talking with. Go to look for somebody that might have some cultural teachings to assist them.
That was Jenny Boyer, Healing and Wellness Coordinator at the Indian Friendship Center in Sault Ste. Marie. Now here's another song from Shane Anthony. This one's called Manitou, and it's a track from his second album, Work to Do.
My heart, you turn us off for your knees for forgiveness. And I'm begging at your feet for forgiveness and peace. And you were on the edge of my lips when I was scared just for me. And you were when the mamas cried out, come on and take me. Just tell me why you afflicted me with sadness at the root of me. Yeah, and digging out, searching for pearls at the root of me. You can't go back, gotta forget Jen and stay the course. You can't forget there was a time when there was so much more to me. And you were there on the edge of my lips when I was scared just for me. And you were there when my mama cried out, come on. And you were there when we all did well. Hello, where you been? And you were there when the mamas cried out, come on and take me, please. And you were there when I dreamed my little dream, my dream just for.
Soul First Nation in northwestern Ontario is trying to save some gravesites from shore erosion. The First Nation has also filed a land claim for unsurveyed reserve lands. Chief Clifford Bull says the shoreline has been slowly eroding since the 1930s when a dam was built in the area, and past treaty issues have never been resolved.
We put forth a news release regarding ongoing erosion in our traditional territory within the community of Lac Seul. Lac Seul is comprised of three communities, Whitefish Bay, Keechee Bay, and Fisherman's Head. And there was some remedial work done at our cemetery across the lake from Keechee Bay at Hudson Bay Post, where the church was. And initially, that was where the first occurrence started coming out in the early 30s, since the dam was built, mid-30s. And Lac Seul is a reservoir. And as you know, people would know that First Nations people at that time lived near water, close to water, and would bury their loved ones near the shoreline. And these graves started being exposed, especially at our cemetery, at Anglican Church there. And we've put forth a plea to the government of Ontario, and since then have did some remedial work at that site in the early 80s. But then there are three communities, and each one has a cemetery, and people lived all over the lake. And there was an A skull found in Frenchman's head that toppled off a sandbank and onto the shore, and along with some bones that were discovered this spring. And we certainly took action, and I myself went to Toronto to try to talk to some government officials, the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs, Deborah Richardson, and we're coordinating some meetings. Things are in the planning stages right now.
Okay, and what do you want the outcome to be?
I certainly would like to see some sort of perhaps a retaining wall be put at the graveyard where the skull was found, and the remains to be respectably picked up and reburied at a higher level, higher elevation, and then some work and money put towards a retaining wall, perhaps with riffraff and maybe some rock and concrete, so we can stop the erosion in that area.
And so moving on to the next issue, I understand that you've put forward a land claim, and can you tell us about that?
Back in the late 1800s, when Treaty 3 was signed in 1873, Lac Seul initially was not part of the treaty. We came into the treaty through adhesion in a year later, and there was the chief of the day and Lac Seul members were talking about three communities be recognized as Lac Seul lands, and one of them being up in Ear Falls, a place called at that time it was called Shoal Lake, and subsequently they changed it to Bruce Lake. But there was about four families that lived up in that particular area. So when the surveyors came out to map out reserve lands, the three that were promised, there was only one that was subsequently identified as being Lac Seul, even though there was three that people agreed to at the treaty. So when the commissioners went up there, the surveyor went up to Shoal Lake near Ear Falls, four families were living there, but there was nobody there at that particular time. So they felt that the area was abandoned, so they left and went back to perhaps Ottawa, I guess. And so we want to revisit that treaty arrangement again, mm-hmm. and we put forth a claim to acquire those lands again for the benefit of the people that live in that area. And we have a big membership up in just north of there in Red Lake, where around Trout Lake, Red Lake, and we have about 80 to 100 members that live in Red Lake, the top of Red Lake, and that's, we want to exercise our sovereignty, our lands, title to that area, mm-hmm. for our people.
Well, it certainly sounds like a familiar scenario where the commissioners or surveys went to the land and thought that it had been abandoned when most of the, a lot of the Anishinaabe people traveled around during the year.
Well, that's very much so is what happened. Lac Seul was the focal point. People would come in from the surrounding area, surrounding traditional territory. We had people up in Trout Lake, Shoal Lake, Sturgeon, they would come and congregate at Lac Seul, and every year they would come and collect and have their marriages and dance and just socialize, and then in the fall they would go back to where their traditional trapping grounds would be and hunting areas. So that was the norm back in the day. So I think what happened there might have been that people were in Lac Seul, but there was nobody up in Shoal Lake where, and the commissioners showed up, where they might have been out hunting or doing other activities on their lands.
That was Clifford Bull, chief of Lac Seul First Nation. You've been listening to Bomb Sida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bomb Sida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Sida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bomb Seda.